It is 8:31, and we have with us live in the studios once again, John Parrish and Maria Tomczyk, co-editors at Eat the State. Good morning to you both.
Good morning.
All right. How are you both today?
Good.
I'm completely sleep deprived. I'm in great shape.
Well, you should.
I got a lot of sleep last night, so I'm fine.
You are sleep deprived. You need to pull that microphone up near your face.
Oh, I'm sorry about that. Does this that work a little
that
bit
will,
better?
That will work better only if you want people to hear you.
Oh, okay. Well, that's actually a different issue than whether people want to hear me. But we'll do our best.
Yeah. Well, we're actually offering filters for that. That's part of our fun drive.
That's only at the $60 level, though, so you got to up your contribution a little bit. We know what the really valuable prizes are. No coffee mugs here.
All right. So let's start out with something that we were going to talk about last week, but we ran out of time. Nucor and Seattle's mayor.
Yeah, this is something that's going to come up in the city council in the next week or so. Not this coming Monday, but the week afterwards. Nucor is the new company that has taken over a plant that used to be owned by Birmingham Steel over in West Seattle. It's the only steel factory industrial facility of that type in the city, and it is by far the largest user of electricity that City Light has, because of course that type of manufacturing process is extremely energy intensive. It's like manufacturing steel, manufacturing aluminum. In fact, one of the reasons the Pacific Northwest has such low electricity rates is because of the aluminum industries up here during World War II that the Bonneville Power Administration was set up to provide huge subsidies to that industry because it uses so much power. Well, about 3 or 4 years ago, Birmingham Steel cut a deal with the city. Birmingham Steel said, well, you know, we might have to shut this plant down if we can't get some sort of a loan, a front from the city in the form of reduced electric rates, that they would get this discount for their massive use of electricity, and then they would pay that back in about 5 years. Well, Birmingham Steel actually did go bankrupt about a year and a half ago, and the plant here was bought by a company called Nucor. Nucor has come back through Greg Nichols, and Nichols and Nucor are presenting to City Council now a plan that would further reduce the electric rates of Nucor and at the same time not pay back what was promised to be paid back those years ago. Nick Licata, the city councilman, is trying to fight this, but at this point we've got a situation where Nichols, the mayoral office, sat on this issue for about 6 months and is now really trying to ram through this discount. Basically, it's corporate welfare for Nucor through both committee and the full city council within the space of less than a month, in a situation, of course, where City Light has had financial problems. The city itself can't you know, really afford to be in the business of corporate welfare and setting that kind of precedent for other businesses.
And hasn't Licata pointed out that this Nucor plant is very profitable for that company and that they're highly unlikely to relocate elsewhere if we raise their rates?
Yeah, it's highly profitable, and they only have really one other plant in the western United States that they could move to. It's in Arizona. It's been mothballed for 3 years. It has much older equipment. So, yeah, the chances of their being able to move are not very practical. It's basically just a political gift. So Licata and some of his allies are asking for people to email or to write or to phone city council people. And I believe his website and his email newsletter has more information on the issue, too, because it has not gotten a lot of press attention. The Seattle Times had a little harumphing kind of editorial about a week and a half ago saying, we need to save these jobs. But the point is, the city already spent money to save the jobs. And the deal was that the money would be paid back. Instead, how many times do you spend money saying, you know, well, we're investing in the multiplier effect of what these jobs mean to the local economy? You can only do that once, and they're trying to do it a second time.
So the people on that subcommittee are Nick Licata, Richard Conlon, David Della, and Gene Godden, who's the person on it.
That is correct. And it's not at all clear which direction Gene Godden is going to go on this. So she in particular is a good person to email.
Yeah. Probably not at all clear to herself currently.
But if this had been brought up at a cocktail party, she'd be all over it.
All right. Moving along, I've got lots of stuff nationally to cover this week. Do we want to dive into? We got like a lot of stuff for this week in Iraq. Want to jump into that first?
We could do that, sure, because we could move from Iraq into the lack of credibility for George Bush. That would be a natural transition.
We could. I just want to start this week in Iraq by talking about the death toll. It's been a particularly bloody week, especially for the Iraqi police in Iraq. On Saturday, a bomb was planted inside a police station in Suwayra, killed four policemen and wounded 10 others. The police captain told an L.A. Times reporter that a policeman must have planted the bomb because only officers have keys to the office where the blast occurred. So far, more than 300 Iraqi police have been killed since the end of major hostilities on May 1st. On Sunday, guerrillas attacked three separate U.S. Army convoys, killing one soldier and wounding three others. The next day, on Monday, two U.S. soldiers died and six were wounded in an explosion at a munitions dump, one of the many accidents that have claimed dozens of soldiers' lives in Iraq. On Tuesday, a car bomb exploded at another police station in Iskandaria, killing at least 55 people and wounding more than 75. Most of the victims were Iraqi men lining up to apply for jobs as security personnel. And it's worth mentioning that that's one of the few jobs that are available now in Iraq under the U.S.-led administration.
You know, a few jobs available to Iraqis, we should clarify.
Yes. Yeah. Uh-huh. We've talked about on this show how a lot of the reconstruction projects are going to U.S. corporations who are subcontracting to, to Saudi Arabian companies, Kuwaiti companies, European companies, who bring in workers from as far afield as Thailand, the Philippines, and South Korea to do a lot of the reconstruction jobs. And the reason why they do this is because it's very difficult for them to tell. They don't have the resources to tell who in Iraq is a guerrilla and who is not. This is made worse by the fact that the looting at the end of the U.S. invasion pretty much destroyed all of the records that would have been able to give a new administration the ability to tell who was an employee of the former government.
Looting that was basically watched by inert U.S. soldiers that kind of let it happen. Halliburton had a particularly bad week also. We'll talk about that after we get done with Iraq.
Right. On Wednesday, less than 24 hours after the Tuesday bombing, a second car bomb exploded outside of a recruiting center in Baghdad in the midst of a crowd of about 300 hopeful Iraqi men also lined up for jobs with the new Iraqi security forces. An estimated 47 of them were killed. The total is probably higher than that now, and more than 55 were severely wounded. In total, nearly 200 Iraqis have been killed in the last 2 weeks in suicide bombings. Most of them were directed at the Iraqi police, although most of the victims were not Iraqi police. They were civilians. On Thursday, guerrillas fired three rocket-propelled grenades at a U.S. military convoy and sprayed it with automatic weapons fire in Fallujah. Now, this is a commonplace attack, but the convoy was not a commonplace one. It happened to be carrying the top U.S. commander in the Middle East, General John Abizaid. He escaped unhurt, but U.S. troops opened fire indiscriminately and killed two Iraqi civilian bystanders. Now, a conservative estimate of the number of civilians killed in Iraq since the start of the war can be found on iraqbodycount.org, and that total is now over 10,000. Almost all of these people have died. Well, all of these people have died because George Bush thought Saddam Hussein might be able to make weapons of mass destruction, I should add, sometime in the distant future, although that's not what he told us at the time.
Yes, it's a program-related activity.
Yes. Yes. Now, I should also mention, too, that a report prepared by the Coalition Provisional Authority and distributed by the U.S. Agency for International Development was released this week. The report was entitled January National Review of Iraq. That report verifies that attacks against U.S. and coalition troops have accelerated sharply in the past month. High-intensity attacks, those involving roadside bombs, explosions, and mortars, have increased over 100% from 316 in December to 642 in January. Non-life-threatening attacks, which would include things like drive-by shootings, stonings, etc., increased by 186% from 182 in December to 521 in January. There were an average of 8 attacks per day in Baghdad alone, up from 4 per day in September, and a total of 11 attacks on coalition aircraft, including both helicopters and planes trying to take off and land at Baghdad International Airport.
Now I have to say, I'm not a great defender of Howard Dean, but the beginning of the end for him in terms of his treatment by national media came with the capture of Saddam Hussein, when he got a great deal of flack for saying that he did not think that the capture of Saddam Hussein would have a particular effect on the attacks in Iraq, and he was right.
He was right, and polls taken at the time of his statement showed that most Americans agreed with him, so he was basically saying what most people thought, and in fact, they were right.
We were right.
We were right, too. Now, speaking of polls, a majority of Americans this week told the Washington Post and ABC in their news poll that they think Bush either exaggerated Iraq's weapons of mass destruction threat or lied outright to the public. That was a total of 52% of respondents. 50% of Americans now say that the war was not worth fighting versus 48% who say that the war may have been worth fighting. In a matchup today, John Kerry would win approximately 52% of votes and George Bush would only win about 43%. So, folks, there is some hope.
Yeah, I want to talk about that a little bit also after we get off Iraq. Or do we want to go ahead and talk about that now?
Why don't you go ahead and talk about that now?
Yeah, I was really amazed. Mostly it's just political junkies who watch the Sunday morning programs, things like Meet the Press, where Bush appeared on Sunday. But between that appearance and interview, which is very rare, Bush has been one of the presidents least likely to hold press conferences or engage in any kind of non-pre-scripted appearance before the media or before the public, and we found out why. Even with Tim Russert offering some pointed questions, but very little in the way of follow up, and there was a great deal that he did not ask. Bush couldn't give answers to a lot of these questions. It seems like it's an almost Nixonian response, and it's worth remembering that Rumsfeld and Cheney, in particular, cut their teeth in the Nixon administration. He seems to be surrounded by people who have a very difficult time admitting when they're wrong, and so what we're seeing now, when it's very obvious that they've been wrong about some things, is that the very tight discipline that the White House held over the people that spoke on its behalf for the first couple of years, where everybody towed the same party line, everybody's been saying the same thing, it's really kind of falling apart. And you're getting a real questioning of George Bush's credibility. We're seeing it around the brouhaha with the National Guard. There was the revelation this week, which didn't get as much attention, that the claim in the 2002 State of the Union address about plans for U.S. nuclear weapons plants being discovered in the caves of Afghanistan by
in the hands of
terrorists, that Greenpeace had to go get a Freedom of Information Act to find out that was a fictitious claim that basically never happened. There are all sorts of
that
ways.
That was basically a lie. There were no U.S. nuclear plant plans of any kind found in the caves of Afghanistan.
Or anywhere else in Afghanistan.
Yeah, it was something that his speechwriters made up, or who knows where it came from. Yeah. But if anybody has any doubts that George Bush can tell a lie, well, there you go.
And we saw again this week further discrediting within the intelligence agencies that George Bush had weapons of mass destruction information. I think it was on Monday that it was released that the key pre-invasion briefing that was given to Bush by the CIA had all sorts of qualifiers and doubts expressed as to whether he had weapons of mass destruction. And in the version that was made public, that was released to the public rather than the top secret version that was given to the White House, the top officials, and to key Republican members of Congress, all of those doubts were excised. It was made to seem a much more certain, much more, there was no room for doubt that Saddam Hussein had these weapons. And if you remember things like Powell's presentation to the United Nations, I mean, we had the addresses, we had the numbers, we had the types. It was, all of this stuff is adding up, and it's adding up, and we're seeing it now with George Bush, where Kerry doesn't even have to be an effective campaigner. All he has to do is not screw up and be the war hero type. And Bush has got to run against Bush. And I think the more that Bush runs against Bush, he's going to lose. Because he, you know, there's really no good, clear way that he can reclaim this credibility once he loses it. And he's losing it quickly, I think, with a lot of people, not just the folks who've been skeptical about his policies and about him for the last 3 years, but folks who voted for Bush 3 years ago are developing some real doubts about this guy and about his administration. CEO types that saw Paul O'Neill's book and saw a description of a man who supposedly runs the nation like a business, has a MBA, but he turns out to be a very, very poor chief executive. He surrounds himself with yes people who tell him what he wants to hear. You know, that's a bad way to run a business. It's a horrible way to have the most powerful job in the world.
Right. And speaking of fictitious information, the Pentagon told reporters on Tuesday that U.S. military operations in Afghanistan and Iraq will run out of money in September.
Oh, yes, the budget.
Yes, the budget. We talked about the budget last week on and the week before on this program and how the Bush administration has left out appropriations for the war in Iraq and Afghanistan. And the Pentagon said this week that they're going to run out of money in September. That means the Pentagon will have to try and fill in a hole of about $19 billion until the Bush administration or another new administration puts together an emergency spending bill in January of 2005, long after the elections are over. Now, economists and military analysts are collectively aghast at the Bush administration's unprecedented use of emergency spending bills to fund these wars, effectively taking them off the public books and out of the budget and hiding the cost from the American people. However, just because the Pentagon can say we will need about $19 billion in order to fill the gap, it's obvious that they know how much the war is going to cost. And it is possible to find out how much it has cost so far. Some of those statistics were released this week. In September, the war cost $4 billion. In October, it was $7 billion. And in November, it was another $3 billion. Now, the December and January figures aren't out yet, but they're going to be higher than December's $3 billion, or November's $3 billion, because of several military raids in December and because of the increase in attacks in January. Now, finally, I want to talk about two diplomatic missions this week for Iraq. One was Donald Rumsfeld went hat in hand to NATO in order to try and get some troops for Iraq, and basically they laughed at him and told him to go home.
Insert laugh track here, yeah.
Yeah, they told him to go home until the security situation improves a little bit. Now, the other diplomatic mission was Lakhdar Brahimi was appointed the new UN envoy to Iraq. He went to meet with the Governing Council and with the Grand Ayatollah Ali al-Sistani to try and persuade them that the U.S. selection process for a new interim legislature in Iraq was necessary instead of elections. What happened, however, is that Sistani persuaded Mr. Brahimi that elections are the fairest and most desirable course of action in Iraq for selecting a new government. Brahimi came away from the meeting not talking about whether elections are possible, but saying, and this is a direct quote, "The question is, when are these elections possible?" End quote.
And by the way, when the media covered this in the United States,
they said the opposite.
No, they did have the quotes talking about how he was looking at when elections could be held, but they left out completely the context that was not his original mission.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they didn't actually describe the process of reversal that he came trying to convince al-Sistani and left basically having sided with the Shiites.
Right, exactly. You have to actually go to the French press agency or the British press to find that kind of portrayal of what actually occurred. In the U.S. press, it was all he supported the U.S. mission to try to persuade Ali Sistani that these elections are not possible, when in fact he came away having agreed to the need for elections and saying, when can we get this done? The June 30th deadline is not something that is reasonable.
Yeah,
and that puts the ball squarely in the U.S.'s court and says, okay, either you can have it George Bush's way, screw this thing up, try to get this nailed down before the election and have it become a complete disaster, or you can let the Iraqi people work with the U.N. and set their own timetable, which is what should have been done in the first place.
Yeah, he was very clear that June 30th was not enough time to hold an election in Iraq, but that it could be done by the end of the year with the cooperation of the Americans. And it was put very, as you say, very squarely back in the court of the White House as to what they're going to do, reminding us once again that the important decisions in Iraq are not being made by the governing council. They're being made in Washington, D.C., several thousand miles away.
That's right.
All right. Well, Halliburton continues to make the news, and not probably the way that they've
cut some TV commercials that are airing in Washington D.C. and Houston and some other cities, in which they're saying, "Yeah, we know we're having a rough time, but Halliburton is committed to honesty and to, you know, the American way," which is, I don't know about that last part. It's probably true, but. They ran into several more pieces of trouble this week. It seems like Halliburton and the whole idea of going in and wading through war zones to try and take advantage of the situation seems to be a kind of a dicey way of doing business. Two Democratic congresspeople, Henry Waxman and John Dingell, released testimony this week and sent letters of inquiry basically to the Pentagon, saying that you should suspend your contracts with these people. What they have is a couple of former Halliburton employees in the office in Kuwait. Now, this is the same office that has had the gasoline gouging incident and the bribery incidents already. And the former employees are saying that there was basically cost-plus accounting all across the board there, that there was essentially incredibly padded expenses, and, you know, the American taxpayers are being ripped off badly is what it boils down to. So this came from a couple of Democratic lawmakers there. At the same time, the government of Kuwait and the finance minister in Kuwait are both launching separately investigations into bribery, kickbacks, and price gouging of Halliburton. And in Nigeria, there is an additional investigation that is being launched. It's already being investigated in France about the accusations that Halliburton has offered $180 million in bribes in order to secure natural gas contracts in Nigeria. Now, this is a country where $180 million goes an awful long way. It's one of the poorer countries in Africa. Between these and Halliburton's involvement in the mineral exploitation in Central Africa, the enormous war there that's cost nearly 4 million lives in the last decade, they're squarely in the middle of that situation, some other trouble spots around the world. I mean, it's real clear that the company that was headed for several years by Dick Cheney is in some real unsavory business all around the world. And once again, it brings into question the credibility and the connections and the favoritism of the Bush administration.
Mm. Something else that made the news this week was Ujamaa.
Yes, James Ujamaa, former Seattleite, who, if you recall, a couple of years ago, he was indicted along with several other people in what was described at the time by John Ashcroft and others as the breaking up of a major terrorist ring. That these were Al Qaeda members who were
These were the guys in Oregon who were going to set up the jihad camp, the jihad.
Yeah, this
vacation
is
camp kind of thing.
Exactly. This is sort of the fundamentalist Muslim equivalent of guys going down to the quarry and shooting off some rounds on the weekend. And if it weren't for the fact that they had brown skin and were wearing turbans, probably nobody would have noticed or cared. But in fact, one of the sheriffs who called the FBI specifically said, that he called specifically because of what they looked like rather than what they were doing.
Right, and it's worth noting that James Ujamaa has not been held because they tried to set up this little camp in Oregon. The reason they've nailed him is because of work he'd done prior to that. When he was in London, he had he'd set up a website and given some computer equipment to a Muslim cleric in London, who at the time the London authorities believed was trying to recruit people to go to Afghanistan to fight for the Taliban at a time when it was not illegal to do that.
Yeah, so what he basically was charged with and finally convicted of this week, but he was given an extraordinarily light sentence, 2 years. He already has about a year and a half of that served, and so he'll be out this summer.
For doing something that was legal at the time.
For doing something that was legal at the time. For associating with a group that was recruiting aid for a foreign government, not particularly a savory foreign government in terms of the Taliban, but they were a government. It was certainly completely legal.
It also raises the issue of if you donate items to a group and you may or may not know what they're going to be used for, yeah, you could be liable for prosecution.
Yeah, it's guilt by association is really what it boils down to.
Yeah.
And but what I was getting to with this sentence is the remarkable discrepancy between the amount of attention that was focused by this administration and the way the media played up. This is a breaking up of a major terrorist ring and Al-Qaeda in America and yada, yada, yada. Well, if Ujamaa and the others that were indicted with him were such a threat to the security of the country, why are they being released from jail in the next few months? Really shows up.
The suspended sentence is going to be about 6 months.
It really shows up once again that the threat that has been hyped by this administration often as not, and that's not to say there isn't a real threat out there, but the claims of victory, the claims of having interrupted threats, the claims that we've captured people who are about to do something nasty to America, that was another issue this week, was Jose Padilla finally being allowed access to a lawyer. Many of these cases have very little evidence to them. They're overhyped or they involve activities that were legal at the time.
And then there's the, just making the papers this week, the story about Ryan Anderson, the local National Guardsman that was accessing things on the internet.
Yeah, he was set up in a sting by, I believe it was the FBI, had someone posing in a fundamentalist Muslim chat room as a member of Al-Qaeda. Yeah, and this Fort Lewis soldier actually contacted the undercover FBI agent, and then he was arrested. So it raises the question of entrapment and exactly how dangerous any of these people are. The people involved in the arrest of this Fort Lewis soldier said it was completely unclear if he had access to any kind of classified information or what information he may or may not have given this person if they'd actually been Al-Qaeda.
So that'll be another one to watch.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, with that, we are unfortunately pretty much out of time. Talking once again with Job Parrish and Maria Tomchik, co-editors at Eat the State, and tell people where they can find Eat the State.
Eat the State is a community newspaper that comes out every couple weeks, pretty much put out by volunteers. We always need people to write for it and help with various other distribution, fundraising, selling ads, various other volunteer activities. You can find the print version free of charge at places where you find free print periodicals, bookstores, cafes, things like that. You can also find the current issue and all of our back issues on the web at www.eatthestate.org. And if you have questions, comments, tips, you heard something that simply outrages you on this program, you can give our voicemail a call so that we can make sure not to call you back if you were outraged. The number is 206-903-9461, and the website again is www.eatthestate.org.